John Coltrane with Blue Train, the title track of his 1957 album, which features some legendary sidemen as well. Lee Morgan on trumpet, Curtis Fuller on trombone, Kenny Drew on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, Philly Joe Jones on drums as well. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're going to have a pretty information-crammed program today. Historian and prolific author Gerald Horn, Dr. Gerald Horn, that is, looks at a few of the contemporary issues and events occurring, domestic and global, through the lens of history, which is his specialty. Dr. Horn is the John J. and Rebecca Morris Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston, and he regularly, as you know, decodes complex social, political, and economic issues here on Lead Stories, and we're very lucky to have him with us on those occasions. He has written more than 30 books. Actually, he's cresting almost at 40 now, and more than 100 scholarly papers on global struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. Most recently, his books included The Rise and Fall of the Associated Negro Press, Claude Barnett's Pan-African News, and the Jim Crow Press, and the Jim Crow Paradox, that was last year, Storming the Heavens, African Americans and the Early Struggle for the Right to Fly, also last year, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, The Rise of the Afro-Asian Solidarity, that's this year, and The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean, also published this year. Well, thank you so much, Gerald, for being with us today and for helping us understand some of these things that are happening both domestically and internationally, that you are so good at giving us an entirely different take on. Thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's start close to home. We have a new government in Cuba. And a lot is being, first of all, it was very quiet. Nothing was said about it. And then when it was acknowledged in the media, it came with the usual stuff of what does this mean? Does this mean that the Castros finally have disappeared in terms of having an imprint in Cuba? Does it now mean a resumption of a different kind of relationship between Cuba and the United States? Are we going to see more aggression? You know, the kind of speculation that goes on. But what is your take?
Well, as you well know, Raul Castro has stepped down as president, but he'll remain head of the Communist Party and head of the armed forces. And Díaz-Canel, who is only 57 years old, is the new president. Given the fact that Mr. Castro will still be wielding influence within the party and the armed forces, which are two of the major power centers on the island, it's hard to say that the Castro brothers, or Raul Castro more specifically, has been pushed from center stage. With regard to the wider picture, it does not appear that the Obama entente with Havana will be continued by the 45th U.S. president, although it's unclear what will be the larger significance, because as we shall be discussing shortly, Mr. Trump has a number of hot spots to deal with regard to Iran, with regard to North Korea, more specifically. And it's unclear if he will want to set another brush fire 90 miles from Florida. That may give the island something of a respite, although events have a logic of their own. And as you probably know, there has been a kind of jousting in the South China Sea of late between U.S. ships and Chinese ships. And as we shall be talking about, I'm sure, shortly, relations between Beijing and Washington are heading south at warp speed. And given the fact that Cuba has become closer to China and historically has been close to North Korea as well, one really can't rule out the possibility of a kind of replay of the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962, whereby Moscow had established a firm foothold on the island, in part to block another U.S.-led invasion, as had happened months earlier with the so-called Bay of Pigs invasion. And that almost led U.S. and Cuba and the USSR to the brink of nuclear destruction. And given the ham-fisted diplomatic approach of Mr. Trump, one cannot, I'm afraid, rule out the possibility of a replay of October 1962 in either 2018 or 2019.
Well, you do have, it is a very strong point you're making. We do have a very reckless government, and one that just can't wait for war, as we saw just last night, the ramblings going on in Syria. But on another hand, we saw that one would think that a new president would, especially when you're trying to, you know, forge some kind of hemispheric harmony and reclaim lost ground diplomatically, at least a message of congratulations or something, but not this president. He has no manners.
Well, it's even worse than that. As they say in Washington right now, it's worse than it looks. What I mean is that if you look at this Iran crisis that's now unfolding, it not only bids fair to lead to an armed conflict with Iran featuring the Saudis and the Israelis, and given the fact that the Saudis are basically a paper tiger militarily, and given the fact that even though Israel is a major power, it is not able really to project force insofar as what is it going to do? Send tanks and armor rumbling through Syria headed towards Iran and therefore get bogged down with flanking attacks from the likes of Hezbollah and the Revolutionary Guards of Iran, perhaps even Hamas? And so basically, the Israelis and the Saudis are seemingly determined to fight Iran to the last dead Yankee. And that does not bode well for the United States government or the people of the United States of America. But not only that, but this conflict with Iran is deepening a rift with the European Union. That is to say that Germany and Britain and France were all signatories to this nuclear accord that was seeking to restrain the development of a nuclear weapon by Iran, are all pledging to keep this agreement intact to the extent that that's possible. But it appears that Washington will be sanctioning Total of France if it fulfills that particular pledge, and Royal Dutch Shell, and Airbus, the Western European competitor to Boeing. And there obviously is a hint as to why Mr. Trump has thrown a spanner in the works by seeking to blunt this nuclear accord, because it could ultimately benefit Boeing, for example, as against Airbus. And this comes in the wake of a decision by Mr. Trump to slap sanctions on steel and aluminum producers from Western Europe, although that's presumably suspended for a few more days, although it's expected they'll become permanent after June 1. And then that's coming in the wake of pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, which President Macron of France came to Washington a few days ago to try to talk Mr. Trump into not going ahead with that decision. And so Mr. Trump seems determined to turn a cold shoulder to what had been thought to be the closest allies of the United States in Western Europe. And I think that there needs to be an agonizing reappraisal in the foreign ministries of these Western European nations, because obviously they've miscalculated, just as a good deal of the U.S. left has miscalculated, and not foreseeing the dangerous turn that U.S. policy would take. And I have a personal anecdote in that regard. Some months ago, I was invited by the German Historical Institute, which is a Berlin entity based in Washington, D.C., that, like the United States, has various entities that seek to have influence in foreign countries. Well, Germany does too. And so they invited me there. And I thought that this was going to be a recognition of the fact that dangerous trends are emerging in the United States, and that perhaps Berlin needs to reach out to progressive, even radical, potential comrades, friends, and allies here in the United States, speaking of people like myself. But lo and behold, once I got there, they were trying to turn me to the right. They were trying to get me to slide onto some right-wing agenda as opposed to following my agenda. And I said, these people are lost. You know, they don't know what time it is. But sadly enough, they're not alone. I mean, think about this. In recent days and weeks, what's happened is that Madeleine Albright, the former U.S. Secretary of State, has published a book, Fascism, A Warning. Cass Sunstein, the spouse of Samantha Power, the former Obama administration ambassador to the United Nations and a Harvard law professor in his own right, has published a volume, Can It Happen Here?, a play on the 1930s book, It Can't Happen Here, that is to say, fascism. Timothy Snyder, the Yale professor, has published two books in that vein, one called Tyranny, the other called The Road to Unfreedom. Michael Kinsley, a former editor of The New Republic and a well-known pundit and commentator, and also part of the 1%, because his spouse is an heir to the Microsoft fortune. He was one of the first to sound the alarm about Mr. Trump being a fascist. And so on the one hand, you have all these forces in the U.S. elite sounding alarm about fascism. Now, of course, you can make a critique of their arguments. For example, you would never know that this was a country based upon mass dispossession of the indigenous and enslavement of the Africans, and a country that endured decades of apartheid, that obviously a country with such a bloody history could easily tip into fascism. You never know that this country has had a foreign policy that's engineered fascist coups in Chile on September 11, 1973, not to mention supporting retrograde and reactionary forces up to this very day, such as in the Ukraine, where according to Stephen F. Cohen, the emeritus professor at Princeton and NYU, the United States is supporting Nazi-like battalions in the former Socialist Republic of the Ukraine. But setting aside those obvious weaknesses, at least they're raising an alarm that I think is understandable, whereas you have our friends on the left, they're, in a sense, they're trying to reassure us that everything is golden. I mean, you know, you have this argument that people who voted for Trump in 2016 voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012, or that the median or average income, depending on who's talking, of Trump voters is $72,000, and that doesn't sound, you know, like the working class to me, they say. Although, of course, you have teachers and coal miners and cops and firefighters who make $76,000 a year. So they're trying to, so the left is trying to reassure us that everything is everything. And the ruling elite, at least certain spokespersons, have tried to tell us that fascism is en route. And I think that, quite frankly, I think the ruling elite, Madeleine Albright and her comrades, are the better of the argument, sadly enough. And that's one of the reasons why we're in such dire trouble right now.
But, you know, there's a fundamental problem here that I haven't figured out what the answer is. And that is, how is a president, whether he likes a deal or not, how does he basically decide as a lone entity that he is going to, quote, walk out of a deal and do so when the world community of nations, this involved a large group of nations who worked on this and agreed to it. How is he allowed to just say, no, we're not going to do that anymore?
Well, I mean, I think that he takes the position that he has the legal right and authority, since this was really not a treaty submitted by Mr. Obama to the Senate, and therefore does not have the cost of a treaty, which gives Mr. Trump a certain kind of leeway in ways. I don't matter of policy. I think it's a matter of politics. And that politically, what this decision by Mr. Trump reflects is, on the one hand, reflects here in the United States of America, a crisis of governance, a crisis of politics, a crisis of miscalculation on the part of a certain wing of the U.S. ruling elite, and the U.S. left with regard to what's possible in terms of a to the right and why. But it also reflects the fact that U.S. imperialism is losing altitude. It's losing altitude with regard to its contestation with China. That, of course, leads us into a discussion of this impending trade war with China, where Mr. Trump is basically asking China to engage in a unilateral surrender to U.S. imperialism, which doesn't reflect the forces on the ground. In other words, Washington is demanding that China move away from this Made in China 2025 program, whereby China is seeking to be the world leader in artificial intelligence and quantum computing and green energy and autonomous vehicles and robotization by 2025, which means that China will be firmly in the passing lane where it is now, and perhaps will have surpassed U.S. imperialism by 2025 if it has not already. And so Mr. Trump, like a latter-day King Canute, is trying to reverse the tides of history. And from his point of view, the United States has a military advantage not only over China, but over the rest of the world, and that this military advantage can be leveraged for commercial advantage. Now, the miscalculation that the Europeans made, among others, was in some ways to egg on Washington as it moved to spend more on the military than the next seven countries combined, on the premise that Washington and Brussels would be allies forevermore. But it does not appear that things are going to evolve in that direction. And given the miscalculation, the idea that the United States is an exemplar of the so-called liberal democracy and the liberal world order, which is a contradiction because, of course, the self-description of the United States is as conservatism is considered to be the lodestar. Liberalism is seen to be a dirty word by the conservatives until when you go abroad and want to spread propaganda, and then it becomes the liberal world order and the so-called liberal democracy. And so obviously the world has been driven into a kind of snarl by the Trump regime, and this has led us directly to the brink and to the precipice of to try to pull out of the nuclear accord.
Do you see a triumph for Trump in this rapprochement with North Korea and South Korea?
Well, it depends on what you mean by triumph. I mean, obviously, North Korea, see what's happening in Iran with regard to Mr. Trump reneging on that nuclear accord and saying what befell Muammar Gaddafi in 2011 when he had an accord with regard to nuclear power with Washington. Obviously, they're going to try to slow walk any kind of denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. And in any case, Mr. Trump, there was a cartoon in the USA Today the other day that showed Mr. Trump playing checkers with Kim Jong-un of North Korea and the North Korean leader playing chess. And what that cartoon signifies in my own mind is that Mr. Trump does not seem to be aware of the law of unintended consequences and unanticipated events. What I mean is that it was apparent that once he moved towards some sort of talks with North Korea, which apparently will be unfolding in Singapore within the next few weeks, that this would ricochet around the region. It's apparently driven Japan and China closer together, the number two and number three economies on planet Earth. Japan in particular feels somewhat betrayed with the talks with North Korea, given the rather ragged relations that existed, that have existed between Japan and North Korea. And just a few years ago, you had Japanese enterprises in China that were being stoned at the behest, at the instigation, if you like, of the Chinese authorities. And now you're having high-level meetings between the Japanese and Chinese authorities. In fact, you're having high-level meetings on a kind of troika basis between the Japanese, the Chinese, and the South Koreans. And if that kind a meeting leads to a relaxation of tension between and amongst these nations that have had contradictions between and amongst them, this could be a real significant and profound alteration in the global correlation of forces, not unlike what happened when Nixon went to China in the early 1970s, which I would argue led directly to the collapse of the socialist camp by 1990.
So, the question has to be asked, compared with the Obama administration, things are moving quite rapidly diplomatically in terms of domestic, foreign policy with the Trump administration. Is it because the Obama administration was kind of laid back and being more careful, or was it because, or is it because Trump has no really great regard for how things are done diplomatically? He's like a bull in a china shop. We'll be right back. listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Our guest was, and I hope he still is, Dr. Gerald Horn, historian, and the best analyst I know of matters political, both on the domestic and international front. But he has left us some kind of a glitch, and we're not able to get him. He's probably talking, not even knowing that he's not connected anymore to us. So we wait for indications that he has realized that his phone is off. So we'll continue. Well, the international world always impacts the national focus here in the United States, and we are at a point where every day there is a challenge because of the way this president does things. And it's not necessarily good, but he is coming across as the can-do guy. We see that former Secretary of State John Kerry and former President Barack Obama are teaming up, trying to counter what they see as a very serious consequence, a likely consequence of the way things are being done now, kind of fast and loose and with no consideration about how the Trump administration is just trampling through fields, fertile fields that were cultivated by a long process of trying to bring everybody together without the charge of coercion or American imperialism. Of course, they're not going to be able to shed that, as the other side also would not be able to shed that. But these diplomatic efforts were so long in the making, and we have, you know, the people are running through the fields with steel-tipped shoes. They just don't care. We're not getting a sense that there's a very deliberate effort to take care of how you do a thing in the short run, because these are all societies that have very long memories, and they plan whatever they do, it's for the long term. I'm not satisfied, I don't think, that the diplomatic initiatives of the Trump administration are coming out of a logical place or a logical way of working. I don't see the Trump administration making an effort to consolidate or to at least find out what other people might be thinking. They don't care about that. Mike Pompeo, who now is Secretary of State, who was the head of the CIA, it seems as if Trump has basically broken up his administration into little fiefdoms. And we have the added aggravation of Israel basically having unfettered access to policy-making decisions in the United States. I mean, everything Netanyahu wants, pretty much he gets. He comes here, makes demands, he gets money, he gets weapons, he gets to break all kinds of long-settled deals and without consequence, and now puts the United States in a situation where it is the U.S. that now has to bear the burden of the consequences of these hot-headed actions. Did we get Gerald back yet?
As far as I know.
Oh, there you are. we just lost you out of nowhere. So you just heard a little banter. I was talking about the feeling from the on this end is that the president and his band of folk are doing whatever it is they want to do, carrying out agendas that are not necessarily U.S. agendas. Intent as he is at destroying Obama's legacy, that's one major quest that he has. He's, as long as he destroys whatever Obama does, even if it made sense. And this means that the foreign policy and foreign policy decision making are in the hands of an administration that is, in the diplomatic world at least, you can consider to be quite reckless. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree that it does appear to be quite reckless, but as noted, Mr. Trump thinks he has a military trump card, pardon the expression, given the fact that the United States outspends the military, the seven next largest nations combined. Mr. Trump also has a domestic advantage that is often unrecognized, and that is, amazingly enough, that the Republicans traditionally win an unhealthy majority of the vote defined as white, point number one, and that with regard to his poll numbers in the Republican Party base, which is overwhelmingly comprised of voters defined as white, his numbers do not seem to be cracking. And in fact, certain polls suggest that his popularity amongst the base may be increasing. And certainly the elections, the primary elections that took place this past Tuesday, give credence to that particular point of view. Mr. Trump is rushing through the Senate confirmations of a host of federal district court judges and federal appellate court judges who will be shaping policies towards the right for years to come. Justice Anthony Kennedy of the U.S. Supreme Court, who has been a kind of swing voter, although it's fair to say that he leans to the right, may be stepping down. He's in his early 80s, which will give Mr. Trump an opportunity to appoint another Neil Gorsuch-type justice to the high court, Neil Gorsuch being the man in his late 40s who was appointed in 2017 after the Senate Republicans led by Mitch McConnell blocked the attempt by President Obama to appoint a federal appellate court judge Merrick Garland to the high court. And with that stranglehold over the courts and with the ongoing state legislation seeking to eviscerate further any statewide impact of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and engage in voting suppression, particularly against black voters who tend to vote against the Republicans by a rate of 9-1, this seems to suggest that going forward, Mr. Trump's path will not be as difficult as it might appear at first glance, given the recklessness, as you correctly suggest, of his recent foreign policy moves in particular. So unless there is some sort of intervening external factor, one can say that Mr. Trump's plans will probably be implemented.
Well, we had an indication of, again, the animus of President Trump against Barack Obama, former president, when Muhammadu Buhari, the president of Nigeria, visited the United States. Considering that it wasn't too long ago that Trump himself had labeled countries like Nigeria and others as, I'm quoting him, shitholes. It never did come up in the course of their discussions, but what was the symbolism or what was the, what was behind this visit, you think?
Well, first of all, President Buhari was criticized by one of his predecessors, President Obasanjo, because of this visit. Others in Nigeria were disappointed that in the press conference after the meeting with Mr. Trump, President Buhari was rather soft-spoken and reticent with regard to this insult that you have just articulated that had been used to describe not only African nations but Caribbean nations. Mr. Buhari has his own problems. He spent a good deal of his presidential term in a hospital in London. And in fact, after leaving Washington, he headed to London, not to Nigeria, for presumed medical care, although he hasn't made clear what his medical issues are. Although since he's pushing 75, it's apparent that he's seen more yesterdays than he'll see tomorrows. Not only that, but the dissatisfaction with President Buhari's rule was magnified when even his own wife began to criticize him. Although Mr. Buhari dug himself a deeper hole when he suggested that his spouse should attend to matters that are relevant either to the kitchen or to the bedroom. Those were his terms, not mine. But I think that the crisis in Nigeria also is not only reflected in the rise of Boko Haram, the religious zealots who capture global headlines by kidnapping teenage girls, which they've done on a regular basis, but also there's the spreading problem with the so-called Fulani herdsmen from the north. Climate change is apparently causing them to move steadily southward, where they're engaged in massacres of those who are not of their religious faith nor their ethnic heritage. However, there were some signs of optimism, I should say, with regard to recent events in Nigeria. Number one, Nigeria has executed a currency swap with China, which has become one of its major trade partners. This will allow China and Nigeria to engage in heightened trade using their own currencies as opposed to the U.S. dollar. Likewise, coming out of the Trump visit, was this decision by John Deere, the agricultural equipment manufacturer here in the United States, to supply thousands of tractors to Nigeria that will then be leased to Nigerian farmers in the Niger Delta who produce rice. Sometimes these tractors can be leased for periods as short as 20 minutes, and that is expected to help make Nigeria self-sufficient in rice, a major component of Nigerian diet. And then there's the African Continental Free Trade Association, in which Nigeria has played a preeminent role, which bids fair to be a kind of parallel to the European Union, a sort of trade union, a trading union, I should say, between and amongst the four dozen plus independent African nations. Now, we're still waiting for South Africa to sign on to this accord, although that is expected optimistically. Then with regard to Pan-African news in general, I think your listeners should pay close and careful attention to the rise and continuing rise of Ethiopian Airways, which is becoming the paramount carrier on the African continent, making it possible, for example, if you want to travel from Mombasa in the east in Kenya to Dakar in the west in Senegal, you don't necessarily have to fly through Paris or London, which has been the historic pattern. You can fly Ethiopian Airways, which is knitting the continent together. And in fact, flies into a number of U.S. cities, including Washington Dulles and Chicago O'Hare and LAX in Los Angeles as well. And that is good news as well. So that, too, will benefit the Nigerian economy, the number one economy on the African continent. And so despite the missteps of President Buhari, there's a certain momentum in place on the African continent that even his bumbling hopefully will not be able to forestall.
Even so, it appeared that Buhari was talking about Nigeria, period, and not the continent as a whole, in terms of U.S. policy toward the entire continent. Even though sometime last year, I forgot what year it was, there was an attempt, a very weak and embarrassing attempt, when the president assembled these heads of state in Manhattan and told them how committed he was to reviving or helping to keep alive the economies of Africa. But I didn't get a sense that there was a continental-wide focus, or that Buhari walked away with any sense of what the Trump administration outside of Nigeria was committed to.
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, Mr. Buhari only carries a brief for Nigeria. I mean, he wasn't authorized by the African Union to negotiate on behalf of 4 dozen plus African nations when he was visiting Mr. Trump. So it's understandable why he would be rather reticent in that regard. But in any case, Nigeria's footprint on the African continent is so large that even if he isn't duly authorized to negotiate on behalf of Africa, the kinds of pacts that he is able to execute with Mr. Trump inevitably has impact beyond the borders of Nigeria. I mean, for example, if you look at this question of religious zealotry, which was on the agenda with Mr. Trump, this, it seems to me, will lead to further military cooperation between Nigeria and the United States with regard to combating the so-called Boko Haram and religious zealotry generally. And then that'll have knock-on effects with regard to similar agreements in neighboring Niger and neighboring Mali. You may have noticed that just a few weeks ago, there was quite an upset in Ghana when there was this notion afoot that the Accra government was going to be trying to negotiate some sort of military pact with the United States that would include, among other things, the United States being able to use Ghanaian radio frequencies. And people took to the streets in significant numbers to protest, and I think that that was totally understandable. And then, of course, across the continent in Djibouti, in East Africa, there is a U.S. military base that has been heavily involved in events in neighboring Somalia, and that kind of interference will probably continue. But your listeners should realize that the U.S. challenge in Africa is being contested from many different quarters, not only by Africans themselves, but also by competing powers. For example, Turkey is playing an increasing role on the African continent, which is a throwback to what happened centuries ago when Turkey was the major ruler in North Africa during the days of the Ottoman Empire. And in fact, if you look at history, you'll find that one of the reasons why Ethiopia was able to escape colonialism for so long was precisely because of its relationship with Ottoman Turkey. And Turkey is a major player in Somalia, for example. It's a major player in Egypt. And, of course, I'm sure I don't have to acquaint your listeners with the role of China. That's the latest bugaboo in the United States, China and Africa. You want to get people excited, talk about China and Africa. But in some ways, that's a misplaced priority because it elides the point that the major Dracula on the African continent historically has been France. Its pretensions to being a major power is basically based upon its domination of nations like Senegal and Cote d'Ivoire and Mali and Central African Republic and Congo, Brazzaville, and all the rest. So, Mr. Buhari, despite his missteps, I don't think is going to be able to halt a certain kind of momentum on the African continent that is able to basically involve playing off one great power against another great power for the benefit of Africa as a whole.
Speaking of which, is there a role here that former President Obama should be playing, in as much as many of these diplomatic initiatives primarily are aimed at dismantling what he had set out to do and, in fact, in some cases, achieved? And we see direct attention to dismantling and throwing these things out. Is he being too polite here, or should he in some way fight for what it is he had achieved that was working or that promised to be beneficial?
Well, first of all, Mr. Obama should carry through on the notion he's put forward that one of the biggest mistakes of his administration, he says, was the aftermath of the attack on Libya in 2011. I would say it was the premise of the attack on Libya in 2011. I think that's proven to be catastrophic. It's plunged Libya into a disaster that's now metastasizing throughout North Africa and having rumblings even to the south in Mali, for example. This attack on Libya was totally unnecessary. It turns out that this idea that there was going to be a Gaddafi massacre, which was the premise of this attack, was a misplaced premise in any case. And also, if you look at some of the research that's come out lately, for example, if you look at the book by former Obama administration ambassador to Moscow, Michael McFaul, he suggests that a turning point in terms of relations between Moscow and Washington, relations going downward, a downward spiral, was 2011 Libya, where Moscow felt betrayed, that they did not contemplate, perhaps naively, that this would lead to a regime change, this United Nations resolution that Mr. Obama pushed through. Now, of course, as you know, you've had credible allegations of slavery returning to Libya as a result of the chaos that has followed the overthrow of Gaddafi. It's rather ironic that the first black president, that his missteps led to the return of slavery to certain parts of Africa where it had been extinguished. So I think that if Mr. Obama wants to do some good, he might want to apply his many talents and many connections to trying to rectify that blunder that he executed in Libya. And he also wants to speak bluntly to the people of the United States. That is to say that I think future historians might see the rise of Donald J. Trump as a kind of counter-reaction to the Obama administration, this fear that the so-called white majority that voted for Mr. Trump felt that they were losing to make America great again, which could be interpreted as returning to the bad old days when white meant more and was valued more highly than it is in 2018 domestically, before the rise of the civil rights movement and the feminist movement began to chip away at white supremacy and male supremacy. And Mr. Obama and many of his supporters, they put forward this kind of what I consider to be a false narrative, which is that whatever is bad, of which there is quite a bit about the United States, they always say that's not who we are. You know, going into an elementary school in Connecticut and massacring kids, that's not who we are. Going into a church and massacring parishioners, that's not who we are. Well, I mean, what kind of nonsense is this? I mean, the only thing we are presumably what's positive, and the things that are negative is not who we are. So I would hope that Mr. Obama, in his memoirs, which I assume he's working on, which he's been paid a pretty penny, that he'll be honest and forthcoming. And because he, you know, this is an intelligent guy, as many people recognize, but tell us the truth, Mr. Obama. Tell us the truth about white supremacy. Tell us the truth about the counter-reaction to your eight-year rule from 2008 to 2016 and what that reveals about the nature of white supremacy in the United States of America. And if you're not able to do that, well, I would suggest that you descend into a lucrative retirement and give six speeches, you know, which is what you're doing anyway, and leave the rest of us to try to work out this mess that you helped.
You know, I can't believe I missed the biggest clue of all, the biggest clue, which was part of the answer to my own question about why he has laid low, because his administration and the Clintons, he can't get around the role of the Clintons. So I guess that's one of the reasons, one of the main reasons that he has laid low and can't defend some of the things that his administration had done or claim some of the victories, because he might as well just invite Hillary along to do to claim the victories. Amazing. What for you is the most, one of the most significant developments in terms of the our national and international policy?
Oh, well, I mean, obviously the recent events. I think that this Mr. Trump trying to thwart the Iranian nuclear accord is significant, not only because it bids fair to lead to a war with Iran, which many commentators are now predicting will take place. Recall that National Security Advisor John Bolton has suggested in one of its earlier speeches that he would like to see the overthrow of the Iranian.
You know, when people do that, I think a very appropriate response would be to give him a gun and fly him there and drop him off and say, you know, keep in touch. People who like these ideas of war, go ahead and fight it. You and whoever in your family thinks like you, go ahead and fight. Oh, we've lost Gerald again. We're having some serious connectivity issues. And but we go through what we must go through. I think one of the things that we have to do is to understand that no matter what these policy decisions are, in the end, it's going to involve us. And we might as well start preparing ourselves to operate very differently, very independently of this government to the extent that we can. This is a crazy government. They're operating like kids in a candy store. They have no real grounding in what is best for the country. This is a kleptocracy, as I've said. Everybody is trying to figure out how much they can steal and get away with it. And, you know, when it reaches this stage and you see the insistence that these folks believe they've created and are still creating a world of their own, it makes no sense to any logical mind. When a guy could just get up in the morning and say, well, you know, we ought to go to war with Iran, they have no clue. And they have no clue because historically, they're not the ones who have been doing the dying. They're the ones who just caused the problems. And the tone of this government more and more is one of out-and-out fascism, undergirded by racism, all forms of discrimination, a very heartless administration. It seems pervasively to be lacking any sense of humanity and logic. And as I've said many, many times, I believe that the President of the United States should really have an intense review by people in the mental health field. I believe that he's a danger. He poses a danger to this country as an untreated person. And heaven knows what else we will have to put up with and suffer from, because he thought it was a good idea. He's running this the way he ran his businesses, and we know what happened to many of his businesses. And the more we pretend that these things are serious pursuits and endeavors in behalf of promoting world stability and peace, the more we pretend that, the worse it's going to be. And everybody else seems to be seem to see the inevitable, that we are moving closer and closer to war. And you see the absolute rejection of that notion, and we are barreling down the road toward war justicing. Gerald, are you still with us?
Oh, I'm still here.
You've been slipping in and out. We've been losing you.
Yes, I know.
But that's
the United States would be spending more on 5G telecommunications than war preparations with Iran.
It's okay. We so value your contribution, both in your writings and, of course, in your teaching and in your lecturing, because you bring to light so many things that we ought to know and we ought to be considering in our daily appraisal of this thing we call our world. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And I'd like you to come back and talk about your latest book, or books especially, sometime soon when you have time. I know you're busy working on two others right now, but at some time soon, we would like you to be here just having a discussion with the listeners. They really want to talk one-on-one with you. So let's work on a time when you can do that. But thank you so much for being with us today. Even with our technical problems, we still got enough done.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope it was useful to you. It certainly was for me. It always is when Gerald Horn is on with us. We had some glitches and we lost him for some moments there. But we rallied through. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.